Continuous improvement comes in lots of different flavors and styles. I'm Bella Engelbach, and I'm inviting you to journey with me to the edges of lean. Episode 123. You can't do lean here, Pharma Marketing Edition, with Terrell Payton. Here at the Edges of Lean, I love to talk with people who have taken lean thinking into spaces far from the shop floor. Terrell Payton is a lean thinker bringing lean and agile to pharmaceutical marketing, a highly regulated, people-focused business area, and one of the places where people are very likely to say, "You can't do lean here." He joined me at the Edges of Lean to discuss why and how he does bring lean to pharma marketing. Terrell Payton, welcome to the Edges of Lean.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really glad to have you here today. And we're going to be talking about something that's really near and dear to my heart, which is the work that you're doing in the pharmaceutical industry. Yes. But before we dive into that, could you please introduce yourselves to the Lean for Humans audience and tell us a little bit of your career path?
Absolutely. So my name is Terrell Payton. I'm the founder and managing partner of Numa Group Consulting, where we help life science marketers prioritize when everything feels like priority. And my career path really bounced back and forth between the agile coaching community as well as traditional management and strategy consulting. I did equal time in both, and I think it really informed my worldview. Number one, around leading with empathy and being human-centric as the core of creating value in any system. But also number two, understanding the language of executives and the language of business value and impact and tying those two things together. I think one of the criticisms that, you know, folks from the lean, agile coaching community get is often, oh, it's fluffy, it's too theoretical. But then on the other side, one criticism that folks from the traditional management and strategy consulting side get is that, oh, you guys are robots, you guys are androids, everything is very analytical. So while I do think there's a fair amount of the analytical side that helps to translate some of these concepts, especially for executives who are looking for where's the impact, I also think that the way you do it, especially if you're talking about human-based systems, is taking a human-first approach, even if you're talking about something like lean or removing waste.
Wow. And how did you get into that? Is it an IT background that you started
yes.
in?
Yeah. Okay. I have not an atypical background for folks like me. Came up as an engineer, moved into project management. From project management, heard about this thing called Agile. From Agile, traced all the way back to great-grandfather Lean to really understand the canon of where these things came from. As my engineering career progressed, I started to become something of an internal consultant. And that's really where I found my passion in learning and understanding how different parts of the business worked and tinkering with things. It was still with that same engineering mindset, but yeah, Thinking about human systems instead of computer systems. From there, I decided to really throw my hat full into the consulting side of the world. So started with one of the big consulting firms that are known for hiring tech people. And from there, really started to get some reps in the enterprise. And from there, really moved more into, I'll say more systems design and organizational systems instead of just teams and projects. And that's where my current career path has taken me, where now, after leaving big consulting in 2019, I started my own firm with the idea behind bringing some of these concepts to life in a really human way.
That's really interesting. And was there a moment, Terrell, where, I mean, coming up as an engineer, where you sort of had an aha and said, hey, these are human systems, it's about the people? Or was that something you always knew? How did that come to you?
No, I wish that were something I always knew. I could have avoided a few missteps early in my career. So before my foray into the agile software world, I worked in petroleum engineering, the petroleum business, primarily in creating these gigantic fail-proof automation systems for large petroleum terminals or facilities. And so if you're on the outskirts of any major city or maybe out by the airport, you'll see these gigantic gas tanks, and that's where the fuel trucks go to fill up, to take gas to the gas station, to take gas to the airport, to take gas wherever it needs to go. Now, those facilities could be a few square miles, but it may only be manned with four or five people. Typically, a general manager, maybe an electrician, a couple techs, things of that nature. And so the vast majority of these facilities are controlled by these automated systems. And you can imagine there's environmental implications. There's, you know, danger implications because we're talking about flammable fuels. There's other considerations just because of the sheer volume. And then you have all kinds of wonky things like the fuel expanding or contracting in the tank, depending on the temperature and the humidity and the volumetric pressure, blah, 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 blah. So long story short, a large, multi-dimensional, complex system that requires you to take an interdisciplinary look. Mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, fluid engineering, and then finally the software slash IT side of things. And all of those things have to work together. So in that extremely high stakes, rigorous environment, I came away with a philosophy that was probably not very much unlike other folks who come up through that same system, which is everything by the book, measure twice, cut once. Everything needs to have an SOP. Everything needs to be infinitely auditable. And in other words, you're trying to remove the variance from this system the same way you would in other non-human systems. And so I think that gave me definitely a grounding in understanding how systems work and how they're interconnected. But it was a bit short-sighted in that my focus was really on the nuts and bolts and the lines and boxes of how the system worked rather than the human components of how systems work. And that's really how systems really work, right? When we architect these mechanical or electrical or software systems, they're typically a reflection of the mind state or the worldview of the people who were involved. So coming from that environment into more pure software, web software, let's just say, my mindset was very much, oh, it's got to be structured. It's got to be rigorous. It's got to be auditable. Everything needs to be by the book. You have to check all the boxes. And then I got introduced to this thing, Agile, where it was like, no, you focus on the things that are highest priority. You cut it up into small pieces. You sequence it out over time. But for a window of time, you really focus on the things that are most important that can drive the most value. And don't worry about all of the SOPs. Don't worry about all that other stuff. If it has value, it will make its way into the priority of work. And I thought to myself, these people in California have lost their minds. That is no way to run a serious system, right? It was some years later in attempting to transform an organization using that very mechanistic view of organizations that I finally recognized maybe I'm looking at this a bit wrong. So despite the fact that I have been exposed to these human-based systems that are very much based on collaboration and communication in Agile, my brain, my mindset was still thinking, okay, if it's big, if it's serious, if it's enterprise, it needs to be lines and boxes, and it needs to be SOPs, and it needs to be this way. It didn't work. Surprise, surprise. And I think most people who come from this very theoretical how things should be mind frame often run headlong into reality. And that's what happened to me. And so in reflecting on that situation, I was thinking to myself, what exactly happened? I had all the SOPs, I had all the criteria, I had everything. What happened? Well, what happened was I didn't pay attention to the humans. And the humans were quietly rebelling against the consultant who was trying to tell them that he knew everything. And so that was really where my eyes started to open to think, maybe there's a different way. Maybe there's a different dimension of this that I'm not quite seeing, because my brain wants to go deeper and deeper into detail, deeper and deeper into the complexity to try to understand everything. And I think that is one way to approach problems, and that's the way we teach people to approach problems, especially in engineering. But I think when you shift to systems that are based on humans, trying to figure out every detail about every human is a poor way to go about and doing it. It's almost like you have to take a step back and look holistically into the signals and the interactions of the system that it's giving you, so that you can sense and respond what this system needs, rather than trying to come up with a mechanistic view where it's like, oh, if I push this button and pull this lever, I'll get this outcome. So moving away from the levers and gauges view of the organization and more to a, okay, this is an organism. This is a living, breathing organism that is non-deterministic, which means that for a given input, I may or may not receive the same output because there are humans involved, and humans are very complicated systems unto themselves. So now we have this system of humans that doesn't really lend itself well to study through this mechanistic way of thinking. And so that was really the start of me thinking about what I do as being more human-centric and less about whatever system I'm looking to optimize. That was a long-winded answer, but I hope it was helpful.
So it really was like running into that brick wall.
Yes.
I wrote everything down. Why don't you all do what I'm telling you to do?
It's so easy. Just follow the process.
Right. And didn't I even like design the process with your input, right? Because you told me what would work best. But yeah, but human beings, like you said, not deterministic. We are unpredictable. We don't know what we're coming to work with every day, how we're feeling, what we just learned, or the other things that we didn't know to tell the person who was helping to get the process written down.
Right.
This has always been like a big frustration to me when working with people. I love value stream mapping, Terrell. And I love the idea of like let's get the whole process and, all the ins and outs, the all of the decision points, all of the places where we're adding value. Let's get that up on the wall and let's really take a look at it. But I think the hard part of that that's always missing is where are the people in here? And it's not just like the numbers of people, like, well, we have three operators at this point. No, it's about where are the people? What are they learning from their management? What is the thing that is standing in their way? What is the decision that they're going to make that's going to be affected by something that a map doesn't see? And
yes.
All of that is so important, right? So it takes a completely different way of looking at the value of the people in the system.
The map is not the territory.
Ah, I love that. The map is not the territory.
But even if it's a value stream map, it's still not quite the full picture.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a picture is never reality, right?
Right.
We try to get close. I mean, we try to build models and, all kinds of things, but we never get real life.
What's that saying?
Models.
All models are wrong. Some models are useful.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, Terrell, you made another big change then. I mean, so you came from, one very highly regulated industry, and I could see where, but in oil and gas, and I could see where, agile would be like hard to understand for you, not just because of coming, from a highly regulated industry, but because the idea of even like you don't beta test something that could kill people, right?
Right.
You want it. It has got to be perfect before you build it out there. You put that big gas tank out there that can explode. You're not going to beta test in the field, right? So just get that concept of we're going to put out today's version. We're going to put out the beta version. We're going to deliver something at the end of the week. It's really hard to get around when you're doing a big project in a highly regulated industry. So now you are working mostly in another highly regulated industry that has the capacity, let's face it, to kill people if something goes wrong. So tell us about that. How did you get there?
Okay, so I went to graduate school because things were feeling a bit stale. So I went to grad school to try to figure out what's my next career shift. And I live in San Diego. San Diego is a bit of a biotech hub. And so I've been traveling for a long time as a consultant. It would be very, very nice to shift to an industry where there's a target-rich environment in my backyard. I can make local connections. I won't be on a plane all the time. So I was intentionally looking to shift from software and IT into pharma/biotech. After I finished graduate school, it was relatively easy for me to get a job at yet another big consulting firm that had a deep practice in pharma. And so that's what I did. I knew that with my consulting background, I could make a lateral shift without taking too big of a hit career-wise and salary-wise, and I could learn, get the reps. There was some similarities, obviously, but a lot of big differences. I'll start with the similarities first. Anytime you enter into a risk-averse industry. And pharma is very risk-averse. I'm not throwing anyone under the bus or saying anything controversial by saying that. The notion of innovation, the notion of doing something different or new, is almost immediately met with, nope, we can't do that. Well, why not? Because that's always the question I ask. Why? Because we're regulated. Okay.
That's always the answer. Well, we're regulated. Well, can you show me the rag? That's the
Yes,
next question.
thank you so much. That's exactly where I went. Because what I found in the pharma industry is that the person you're talking to, that line of business leader, has gotten more than likely a third or fourth person interpretation of some reg out there somewhere. So I'll break it down. FDA releases either guidance or a regulation. Regulatory affairs gets a hold of it, and they look at it and they see the parameters, and then they make an interpretation. Okay. Then they hand it over to their friends in legal. They say, hey, legal, we want you to look at this to make sure we're not putting the company at any legal risk, so on and so forth. And then legal says, yeah, looks good. But just to be sure, we're going to interpret it like this. Okay.
As and you
So
can,
then
for
it
those of
gets.
you who are listening, he's got his hands broad and he's narrowing, narrowing,
Yes.
narrowing. So you're coming to a very a narrow interpretation
Yes, the
that
fish is
is
getting
good
smaller.
for a because it was good for a risk averse company, right? Because you don't
Yes.
want that FDA warning letter and you don't want those big lawsuits and
Right,
the
exactly.
yeah.
So, point being, by the time it gets to that line of business leader that I'm having a conversation with, they've gotten a third-party interpretation where every interpretation took it a little bit more narrow just to be sure. And so that person gets an interpretation of a regulation that says, here's what you can do. And for those of you listening, my hands are very, very close together. So it's a pretty narrow latitude of things that you can do. And so I like to reason from first principles. I had the benefit of working with a very young, very small biotech early in my career switch. And we were developing our internal processes to for verification and validation of a new medical device for diagnostic purposes. And so we literally called the FDA and we said, hey, this is what we're trying to do, and this is how we're trying to do it. Can you give us any guidance? And the FDA says, absolutely. Number one, we love to hear this because we actually like the idea of concurrent engineering. Number two, whatever process you develop doesn't have to follow the way that processes normally go. You need to create a process that can generate evidence that you are following that process and that when you get audited by the FDA or whomever, you can show evidence that this is the process we follow. It doesn't have to be some sort of lockstep process. And of course, with software these days, everything can be automatically time-stamped and put in a system of record and so on and so forth. But the FDA, as well as other regulated industries, tend to have a few things in common. Number one, the knee-jerk reaction is we can't do that because we're regulated. But number two, the culture of the organization tends to hire, recruit, and reward people who are rule followers. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. What I mean is you typically have people who are extremely intelligent, very smart, have always been academically successful, typically have terminal degrees, PhD, MD, et cetera. And they've always lived in the world where there was an exact right and wrong answer. And so when you introduce ambiguity into this kind of system that has always had these very strict rules and structures, people lose their frame of reference and they lose any sense of being able to anchor and reason through things through first principles. And that tends to be a side effect of the industry and the industry's culture, but that's a big part of the thing that we have to try to unlock. One thing I will say, in addition to being risk averse, there tends to be a much stronger culture of agreement and committee, right? There's a stronger sense of democracy that I've found in the pharmaceutical industry compared to, say, oil and gas or even software, where oftentimes people don't feel comfortable making a controversial choice and really setting themselves apart as a leader or as a decision maker by making a decision that may be unpopular because it's against the status quo, but still is the right thing to do. That's a gigantic challenge that I've noticed. And I think it all ties back to the sense of risk aversion, which affects not only how people approach the work, but also how people approach each other. There's a in a lot of companies, there's this sense of, well, If I don't go along with everyone, I might be seen as not a team player. And so there's this additional level of cultural conformity that I think comes along with being a tightly regulated industry and having legal folks and regulatory affairs folks and other folks around always kind of policing and watching. In the case of marketers, they always have to go in front of the review committee. Some review committees are very collaborative and very helpful and look at themselves as in service to the marketers. Other review committees see themselves as the last hope before marketing does something stupid. I'm not going to quote the company, but there was a review committee member that I talked to asking about the mission and the vision of the review committee as it pertains to the business. And that is literally what came out of this person's mouth. We are here to keep marketing from doing something stupid. So you can imagine with that overarching umbrella of risk aversion, these internal cultural traits of conformity, of always being right, always having the right answer, not being very comfortable in ambiguity. And then you layer on top of that, sometimes a bit of a sense of misguided or misalignment of mission among these groups that are supposed to work together. And you get a very target-rich environment for the kind of work we do.
And I think, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting about that is that relationship between, say, medical and marketing, right? Mm. So marketing is not really, quote unquote, allowed to be involved in the drug development process. And that, you know, there are reasons for that, right?
For sure.
But what that means is that I think that sometimes that R&D, and for those of you who are not in the pharma industry, you know, maybe this is the kind of thing happens in your industry too. It'd be interesting to know. But that R&D gets very focused on the science of the particular molecule or device that they're developing. They get all wrapped up and excited about the science. They fall in love with the product.
Yes.
Marketing's thinking about the patient.
Yes.
And of course, marketing also has goals to meet. R&D has goals to meet. And I think that, you know, they do get misaligned. And I think that one of the biggest challenges is reminding R&D that they should be as focused on the patient as they are on the science, right? But also, you know, marketing, as you're saying, and this is why those review committees act that way, marketing needs to always bear in mind that you can't say something about a product that the science doesn't support, right?
Exactly.
So where you're right, it does look like misaligned goals, misaligned purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a lot of friction. And it's that moment. And I think you don't necessarily deal with product launch, but that moment, well, now it's going to go out and actually people are actually going to buy this thing. And hopefully it's going to change their lives in a positive way.
Mm.
It should be a huge triumph for R&D, but it's only a huge triumph for R&D if marketing is actually able to sell it, right? And that's totally different sort of can of worms. So can you tell us, for the folks who are not involved in this industry, what is it about pharmaceutical marketing that is so challenging?
Sure. There are a number of challenges. And I think for any of us who are involved in organizational performance, none of these things would sound unfamiliar. Collaboration. Left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. People don't know how to organize and orchestrate the work. People don't necessarily know how the work that they're doing ties to the broader goals of marketing, to the broader goals of the organization. But here's where we focus. And I always start this conversation by asking a question. How do you prioritize when you have a mountain of stuff and everything feels like top priority? And to make this a little bit more concrete, imagine a marketing team that has their regular day-to-day evergreen campaigns or keep the lights on or business as usual things that they have to do. And then there's a product launch looming on the horizon, right? So you have this ongoing body of work, but then you have this spike where it's like, okay, how are we going to do this when we're already full with just the things we do day to day? And on top of this, we need to be preparing for the launch. So I think all of us deal with this in our respective roles, but for pharma marketers, it's a particularly acute problem. And I think that problem falls on the back of a few trends that we've seen develop since the pandemic. Number one, teams have forgotten how to collaborate. In a world before the pandemic, companies were very much moving in the direction of open spaces, open collaboration, design thinking, getting people together, cross-functional teams, et cetera, et cetera. The pandemic came and put a nuclear bomb in the middle of that and atomized everyone back to their homes. And I think in the early part of the pandemic, people were just trying to figure out how to deal. Oh, my kids are at home, but I'm also at home, and that causes problems because I'm supposed to be helping my kid with my schoolwork, but how am I supposed to do that when I'm in meetings all day? My husband or my wife, hopefully we can coordinate schedules. Oh, now the UPS man is at the door. This is driving me crazy. And so I think employers at that time were really focused on how do we keep our people productive? And I think a lot of employers saw a big bump in productivity at the beginning of the pandemic because everyone was home and now all of a sudden you could work more. And I think a lot of us did. And it was really challenging to find that balance at the beginning of the pandemic. People started literally zooming out, as in, you know, Zoom fatigue, having too much time sitting down, not able to find the appropriate balance. So that's one. Alongside that, because everyone got atomized, here we are now, let's just call it 2024, 4 years on from the pandemic. So a whole new generation of professionals have entered the workforce over the pandemic. Teams have switched around, people have gotten promoted. So in some cases, there are teams that have been working together for years that have never met in person, which is appalling. But that's another ongoing, let's just call it, component of the initial challenge. And then third, which is kind of an evergreen challenge, if you will, there's always more stuff to do than there is people and bandwidth to do it. Those always. Three things combined with the fact that people feel socially isolated to really exacerbate some of the challenges we see, where people are afraid to say no, people are afraid to say I'm full, people are afraid to have transparent conversations about priority and what's going to drive business impact and what they should and shouldn't be doing, not even necessarily employee to boss, but even horizontally, because everyone works in teams now, and everyone feels this pressure to always say yes and do more. And on the other side of that, you see a few negative impacts. Number one, our marketing campaigns are all over the place. Number two, the focus and the behavior that we reward tends to be on activities and outputs rather than driving outcomes and driving impacts. And so you have people who are like, well, clearly the way I get ahead in this company is by taking on as much stuff as possible, even if the quality of my work output is somewhat negligible. And so all of these things, I think, have put us in an interesting spot. And I've done a lot of thinking about this and a lot of chatting with marketers about it. It's almost kind of like a perfect storm. But the good thing is these are not insurmountable problems. And these are problems that we have already solved in previous generations. And I can hear all of the people that are listening to your podcast right now nodding in agreement, because there's nothing new under the sun, right? I think the times have changed, the technology have changed, the interaction model has changed, but the basic tenets of how to get humans to work together effectively have not changed. We just have to find different ways to approach it in this modern era where you're not really close enough to people to smell them the way you would in a true group dynamic where you're literally feeling each other.
Are you seeing companies starting to bring people together, say for, you know, a team kickoff meeting? Are those things happening again?
We're starting to see a little bit of that. I'm advocating for it pretty strongly. If a company doesn't already have regular quarterly bringing people together, I recommend that as a bare minimum to form some sort of community. You know, something a lot of executives don't understand is that historically, as in before the pandemic, people used work and their workplace to meet a portion of their social needs, because you would go to lunch with your coworkers. You, in some cases, would have communities of interest inside the job. And occasionally your workplace relationships would spill over into quote unquote real world relationships. But still, you would go to a place, you would go to an institution, you'd be surrounded by other humans who are pursuing the same mission. You'd be eating together, you'd be chatting, you'd be having water cooler conversations, et cetera, et cetera. So there were ways that the traditional workplace was actually healthy for us as individuals compared to where we are now. And I don't think we'll ever go back to where we were before. Obviously, it depends on the company and the industry, but the cat's out of the bag. So in a world where a vast many of us work from home, we've been strongly advocating, at a minimum, get everyone together once a quarter. Ideally, more often than that, maybe at a departmental level, once every 6 weeks or so in a smaller gathering, or maybe on a regional level, if you've got a critical mass of folks in, say, San Francisco or in the Pacific Northwest, you know, put some funding together to let those people to get together and really form community. Don't worry so much about what's the ROI of this, because the ROI of this is pretty clear. If Bella shows up to work and Bella's got friends at work and Bella feels supported at work, and Bella feels like, you know, if I get stuck doing something, I could call my friend Terrell and he would either talk me through it or he would refer me to somebody else who really knows about that. So now Bella shows up more engaged. Bella's willing to work harder. Bella's willing to work longer. And more than anything, Bella feels a sense of belonging in that organization. We have to bring back the sense of belonging before we can get to the higher levels of the stack that really have to do with productivity and performance and all of those things. If you think about it as a almost like a pseudo hierarchy of needs, and for those of you listening, I tend to gesture a lot with my hands. So right now I am creating the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak, talking about the foundation. In the work sense, the foundation of us being able to perform well is really feeling like we're part of something and that we belong to something and that we need people and they need us and everyone has bought into that social contract. So we're really trying to bring that back. Obviously, it's challenging. A lot of companies have divested of office space, have divested of some of the trappings of office life. And, you know, the CFOs and the finance people are like, woohoo, look at all this money we're saving. And then department leaders are coming and saying, actually, I'd like to carve out $250,000 for this regional gathering that I'd like to do with my department. And because not everyone lives locally anymore, we have to fly folks in. And, you know, there's logistics involved. But I think it's a useful, helpful, and very effective investment to make. So, you know, people are starting to naturally have quarterly all hands in person, but we're advocating for a bit higher cadence of that, especially as the proximity of people who work together gets closer. We recommend they get together more often. And we're also recommending that for people who might be in an area where the company is not, but they're just local to each other, three or four people get together every other week for lunch or something like that. It seems really simple. It seems almost trivial, but there's something very, very real to close proximity to each other. We need to be able to smell each other to understand and really connect and create these campfire moments. I'm a big fan of Charles Vogel. I think he mentioned that in one of his books, creating these campfire moments where I think for all of us, if you've ever been out camping and three or four people sitting around a fire, telling stories or just talking about life, or in some cases, just staring up at the stars and going, wow. And you get up from that campfire experience and, you know, you feel like you're glowing on the inside because that's what connection feels like. There are ways that we can engineer this in our workplace. And aside from our core work, which is really about marketing performance, as a necessary precursor, we talk a lot about how do you bring your people together as a community first, as a precursor to that collaboration.
Which then leads hopefully to outcomes. I want to ask you a question about something you said earlier, which is you said that you see people sort of doing a lot of activity. You know, is it, you know, I don't know if it's busy work, you know, but I've got this checklist I've got to follow, or I've got to read all my emails, you know, whatever it is, right? But you're not seeing, they're not necessarily delivering outcomes or delivering quality outcomes. Do you see people in marketing, because I know we see this in other parts of industries, really struggling to define what the KPIs are for outcomes, you know, how are they actually going to measure those outcomes other than sales, right? Because that's sales is such a far down the road outcome that, you know, you don't want to wait, you know, you don't want to wait till the end of the week or the end of the quarter. So how are people grasping that, or is that something they need help with?
People need a lot of help with it. And a couple of trends that I notice is that, number one, people tend to not want to commit to any sort of outcome because it's, you know, it's black and white as to whether or not you've been successful. Oftentimes, in the absence of a real strategic focus on driving a specific outcome, people focus on, look at all the stuff I'm doing. And so they bring that to their boss, and their boss says, okay, I guess that looks good. And so they walk away thinking, great, I'm good because my boss says it's okay, which means that win or lose, no matter whether this turns out well or not, I've got the air cover of my boss. There's a certain level of personal and professional risk you take on when you say, I'm going to increase this metric by this much. And when I say this metric, I do not mean sales. Often sales is used as this smokescreen of, oh no, we can't measure anything because it takes so long. And at the end of the day, it's really all about sales. And to which I always make the argument, sales is a lagging indicator.
It's such a lagging indicator.
It's a rear view mirror metric. But what's a steering metric? What's something that we can understand and start to drive in terms of impact that is a precursor to probably a bundle of other things that lead to those sales? In other words, how can we tighten up the aperture of where we're focusing on and really get crisp on what actually matters? So that's the argument that I make internally. But like I said, it's often the argument that I'm making. Another thing that I see is that because there's this reluctance to really bear down and say, this is what we're committing to moving in terms of a key metric, it becomes pervasive in the culture that everyone gets this activity focus. And whenever you ask about, okay, well, how will you know if this is actually working before the 12-month sales cycle or even before the quarterly sales cycle? How will we know this is working? People look at you like you're growing an arm out of the front of your face because it's not typically how people think. And in a lot of cases, people have been doing this for a long time. And when you've been doing something for a long time, you have certain ways that you like to approach things. And so it often becomes a laundry list of tactics that you're going to do rather than a pointed understanding of strategically, how are you going to move this particular set of KPIs in a direction that proves that you are driving the appropriate outcomes for the business. There's a real reluctance for that. And honestly, not a whole lot of rigor and discipline around just the scientific method of how you might go about as a commercial organization in creating a hypothesis, testing it, and then looking at the evidence that either validated that hypothesis or refuted the hypothesis. And I find that extremely interesting considering that most pharma companies consider themselves scientific organizations. But that scientific thinking doesn't necessarily make its way to other parts of the organization when there's human emotions involved, and it's a lot easier to wiggle out of the disciplined, rigorous way that you should pursue validating whether something is fact or opinion.
And that you, Terrell, you just actually, that was my TED talk. I did a TEDx talk, and it was exactly about that. It
Really?
was about, yeah, it was about what happens when a scientist leaves the lab. So the scientist will be working in the lab, entry level, postdoc, whatever the degree is, they're working in the lab and they are doing science. They're designing experiments, running experiments, analyzing the data, adapting, creating a new experiment based on what they just learned. The minute, I swear this is true, the minute they become a manager, step out of that lab, some of them never go back to the lab again, but the minute they step out of that lab, that process is forgotten and they start to manage by magical thinking. I would like this thing to happen. So I'll try this, see what, and maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't happen. Then we go back to your oil and gas example as well. Can we just write an SOP and people will follow the SOP and somehow by magic, this thing's going to happen. But that scientific rigor that we use in our R&D labs, in our clinical labs, is the same scientific rigor we can use all over the company, right? And so that's something those PhDs, MDs could actually support the marketers in if, if they could teach it in a way that was not, not too offensive and, but this is how you should be thinking about this. You think this thing is going to work? Well, what's the experiment you can design to see if, is it going to work or not? How quickly can we run that experiment with good data? All right, what does the data tell us? What are we going to do next? I mean, that's lean, right? That's PDCA. But that is endemic to the pharma industry. And then I think, you know, what I see in other industries is it's just not thought about at all, because if people are coming out of business school, they don't think that way.
No, not at all. And I think in pharma, again, going back to one of my original points around these are people that have been conventionally academically successful their whole lives. And so the primary fear is, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong? And I'm like, it would be great if you're wrong, because then we know. Well, and it's not so much what if you're wrong versus what if you're right. The challenge is, how do we design to figure out whether you're wrong or right as soon as possible, instead of what typically happens is, oh, I feel like we should do this. And then you start doing this, whatever it is, 3 months in, 4 months in, 5 months in, this is not working. And so rather than saying, okay, this is clearly not working, a lot of effort gets put into managing the optics to make it look like it's working, rather than having to admit you're wrong. And the longer you get into that cycle, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, the more pressure there is to prove that this thing is working because you've continued to invest in it. As opposed to what I always suggest is, what's the 1 month experiment we can run so that we find out whether we're on the right track or not quickly. And so being willing to admit you're wrong is much easier 3.5 weeks in, when it's like, right, we had this hypothesis, we ran this experiment, this is the data that came back, and we found out we're wrong. So guess what? This is no longer an experiment we're going to pursue, or we're going to change this factor or this factor. We're going to tweak it and run a different experiment. But the point is, it needs to be part of a regular, systemic, disciplined process of validating your thinking against the market, rather than the magical thinking that you were talking about, followed by the political maneuvering to make it look like your thing is working so that you can get a promotion. And that's really the kinds of organizations we want to work with. The organizations that are more interested in actually performing better at a higher level, and less so in managing the optics or managing their SVP or whomever. They have to be interested in actually doing better work and driving better business impact. And we show them ways to demonstrate to the rest of the organization that this is what they're doing, even though it might look differently than how things are typically done. And how things are typically done is months and months and months of strategy meetings and planning meetings and these 40-page PowerPoint decks that immediately get abandoned the week after that meeting is over and are never thought about again. And maybe 6 months down the line, there'll be a half-year update on that big strategic initiative with a bunch of gobbledygook that nobody really understands. It's a big yawn. And I see companies waste money and time and resources on this kind of thing over and over and over without any real sense of what is it that we're driving toward here.
And also that idea that, you know, well, somebody's going to come in and they're going to show us exactly how we're supposed to do this, or we're going to be able to buy a system that will do it for us.
Oh, you keep hitting all my hot buttons. That's the other one. That's the other one.
Sorry,
Oh,
Terrell. Sorry
we'll
about
get
that.
this piece of software, and then ... it will solve all of our organizational, cultural, interpersonal, and strategic problems. Absolutely not. It can sometimes be useful, but from my perspective, if you don't have the appropriate cultural systems in place, it'll be a hindrance. It'll be another distraction, because now people are pointing all of their ire and, you know, the blame on the new system rather than the things that have already been implicated as part of the challenge. In other words, software can often be helpful, but it is insufficient to solve organizational problems.
Could you quickly describe for us some of the attributes of a leader that would be successful in the type of system that you're describing? The good system, not the bad one.
Sure. I would think, first of all, that leader needs to be willing to model the behavior they want to see in the rest of the organization. Full stop. And so if you're expecting vulnerability, you need to show vulnerability. If you're expecting collaboration, you need to demonstrate collaboration. You need to demonstrate what good looks like. And if you don't know what good looks like, well, you can go to a Bella, or you can go to a Terrell. There's a number of really, really smart people who can help you understand as a leader how you need to show up. So that's first and foremost, demonstrating or modeling the behavior they want to see in the rest of the organization. Second, empathy, 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 empathy. I don't know a lot. And oftentimes I am the dumbest person in the organization that I've been called in to consult. But I lead through empathy. I lead through asking and feeling and really trying to understand people's perspective. And I think that's a way that, and I tell this to leaders all the time because they say, well, if people would just do what I say, we wouldn't have any problems. And I'll say, okay, listen, dear leader, there is no one in this organization that reports to me. Yet I routinely show up to organizations where no one reports to me and immediately start ordering people around and asking them to do things that will make them uncomfortable or otherwise that they don't want to do. How do I do that? Well, it's not through positional power. It's through empathy. It's through trying to connect and understand where they're trying to go and align what I'm trying to do to their goals. So leaders need to be able to do that. A lot of leaders come up through a business and say you're a VP of marketing. Oftentimes people get into that role because they were really, really good marketers. It's a different job as a leader. It's not how good your marketing chops are. It's how well you can inspire followership, how well you can model the organizational behavior you want to see, how well you can empathize and demonstrate that vulnerability and empathy in every interaction with your people. And then the last one, you know, if you're looking for an organization to help you build into the future, like in order to go from where you are today to where you want to be. As a leader, you have to be willing to be vulnerable and invite people to the journey. So I just mentioned a bunch of stuff that people might not necessarily associate with traditional quote unquote leadership skills, which for the most part, people think for the uninitiated means ordering people around and telling people what to do and how to do it. Yeah. But it's really all about inspiring people to give you their best. And they can only do that when they feel like you have their best interests in mind and that you're on the same side of the value equation, fighting the same fight, but also expressing the same vulnerability and collaboration and empathy and all the things you want to see in your organization. That's what I would put as the new skill set for today's leaders.
That's great. Hey, Terrell Payton, how can people find you?
Thank you very much. You can find me on LinkedIn. I am Terrell Payton. You will notice me by my colorful shirts and green glasses. You can also reach me at www.numagroup.com. I would love to talk to anybody out there who's interested in any of this nerd stuff that I was just talking about. Would love to hear from you.
That's great. What's your one piece of advice for a young person starting out?
It's funny. It's almost identical to what you asked about leaders. A little bit different, a little bit more tactical. To a young person starting out, number one advice, learn to write. And I know that's not typical and people are like, what? That's left field. Learn to write because learning to write forces you to clarify your thinking and it makes you a better thinker. If you can think and reason through things and you can communicate them either by writing or through speaking, learning to structure your communication, learning to be crisp, learning to have your points well articulated, that will put you ahead of 80% of the people that you encounter, even if they are quote unquote smarter than you. So that's one side. The other side, learn to empathize. You can get yourself out of a lot of sticky situations by leading with empathy rather than whatever neurotic thing you think you should know as a young professional that you don't. Anytime you're in an unfamiliar situation, empathy. What is the person on the other side of this equation thinking? And if I don't know, how might I ask? How might I find out? So that's really what I would focus on. Critical thinking, critical speaking, critical writing, and empathy.
Beautiful. Hey, Terrell Payton, thank you so much for traveling with me to the pharmaceutical edges of Lean and all the rest of it. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Terrell Payton for being my guest at the edges of Lean. What did you learn from this conversation? What ideas did it spark? We would love to hear from you. You can find Terrell at numagroup.com or on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn or at leadforhumans.com or comment wherever you watch or listen. Don't forget to subscribe and check out all my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com, where you will find lots of great new content every week. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelbach with support from Podcast Inc. This is a Lean for Humans production.